Good morning. So last time we talked about this idea called cache blocking, which was a way we could organize code, particularly code that does something over matrices or arrays, to make better use of the cache. And kind of the basic idea is that we try to group our work, whatever calculation we were doing, into subsets of the data that would fit in the cache. And by grouping it this way, we'd reorder from many of the common naive orders, where we'd have, if we had either a matrix or multiple arrays, we'd end up having some forms of bad locality in the naive version, and we'd fix these by sort of deliberately grouping the work into things that fit in our cache. And so sort of the basic pattern is we have some sort of loop that goes over a whole bunch of indices, say I, j, k, whatever our indices are. And instead of doing that, we'd sort of choose starting points for our groups, and we'd have these ranges of those indices that are contiguous, and because they're contiguous, they're likely to have good spatial locality within them. And because we're doing all the work for those, for that group of indices that we can, we'd hopefully have more temporal locality than our naive solution would have, where we'd have to wait, you know, for us to go back to the same I or same I plus J later on. Here we do it sooner because we do everything we can with that I plus J within that group. Some questions about cache blocking. And I guess I also mentioned the name's kind of unfortunate because the blocks being referred to by the name cache blocking are not the blocks in our cache, but that's how people like using terminology, unfortunately. Okay. So then we talked about, started talking about optimizations which don't have to do with the cache. We talked about optimizing for the cache, but we're talking about optimizing how instructions are run, and we're going to do that with this idea of how sort of modern high-performance processors work. We start with something which doesn't require much about the processor, which was loop unload. So here we said we had a loop, and we would just copy the loop body to do more iterations of work. This would typically be something we'd use with something where we had like a for loop with some body X, and basically we transform that into a NOR for loop that does the same thing, where we had several copies of the X, and to fix that, we would be changing a plus equals one to a plus equals however many copies of X we made. And the reason why this helped our performance is because, well, all the stuff that is that for loop's bookkeeping of incrementing the index, checking if we're done with the loop, jumping back to the beginning, all those instructions don't get duplicated when we do this. They get changed a bit, but they don't get duplicated, so we're running less instructions. There's less work for the processor to do the same actual calculations, because presumably the stuff in the loop body is what we really care about. Now, there's some things we need to worry about with this. And the biggest one is that, well, you know, we're changing what the loop does, and this doesn't handle cases where the loop would run for a number of iterations which isn't a multiple of the number of copies of the loop body we made. So we'll need some extra code to handle any leftover. And that's going to mean that this loop unrolling idea is not actually going to help us in cases where we have like typically three iterations. It's going to make things slower, in fact, because we'll have this extra code to handle the leftover. And also, we're still running the bookkeeping code like almost as much. You know, so it only really helps when we have a lot of iterations. And when we looked at the performance of this loop unrolling idea, we said, okay, well, we keep running less and less instructions, and it keeps running faster, but then it plateaued somewhere. And on my laptop, it plateaued, for our example, at having one cycle per iteration. So one thing that meant is that my laptop processor can start multiple instructions and finish multiple instructions per cycle. So it's not, so it's a design which is fancier than our pipeline design. And another thing I mentioned is that my lockout processor actually runs instructions out of order, that when it's waiting for a slow memory access or other slow instruction, we'll find other things to run. We started looking at sort of what sort of strategies is it using to actually handle dependencies and hazards in that out of order design. And this is going to be useful for us to know because we want to know, well, when I write code that uses less instructions or uses different instructions, when is that actually going to run faster? And knowing when are my laptop processor is going to do something like stalling is going to help us do that. So questions about loop unrolling and sort of the basics of out of order, we'll go back to looking at our examples of what the hazards look like that we finished on last time. Okay, so last time when we were looking at order, I mentioned that we have new versions of hazards we've seen before. So one was, you know, before we had to worry about, oh, if I'm forwarding, I need to have two different versions of array. I need to choose the right one. We chose it based on it being an execute. That trick doesn't work anymore because with out of order execution, it could be the case that we decide to start something more recently that is actually a more out of date instruction. And we need to know that, you know, which version of R8 we need depending on which instruction we're running. And so the strategy we're going to use for this is that we're going to sort of rewrite our instructions to indicate what version of each register they use. So here, rather than saying all these instructions use R8, I've indicated which version of R8 they read from and which version of R8 they write to. And now when I want to check what value to forward, I'm going to say, I want to forward the version we're reading from. So for the add from R11 into R8, I want to forward version 2 of R8 to that instruction. And the value that instruction produces is version 3 of R8. So it can only be used by instructions that want version 3 of R8. So rather than matching on R8, we're going to match on R8 plus the version number when we do forwarding. And this is going to avoid the issue of having multiple different copies of R8. There's only going to be one because we're actually matching R8 version X. And in particular, this solves another sort of, well, this is going to be the basics of our solution to another sort of problem that comes up out of order processors, which is something known as a write after write hazard. So when we're doing things out of order, it may be the case that we want to write the different versions of R8 in the wrong order. So in this example, the way we executed things, well, we decided, oh, R10 and R8 weren't available right away. So we started that first add instruction's actual work sometime later than this IR move queue into R8. And the version of R8 we want when we're done is the version from IR move queue, the value 100. But we still need this other version of R8 up here because, you know, we need it for this RM move queue that we haven't started yet. That presumably we haven't started because we don't like know where RAX is yet, perhaps. So we need to actually keep copies of multiple versions of R8 even when we're not actually executing instructions to implement this out of order idea. And this is in fact what typical out of order processors do. So I'm going to describe to you sort of the most common type of strategy that's used these days to implement out of order. It's not the only way of doing it. And in this strategy, we keep multiple versions of every register. And the way we do that is that we're going to have lots of registers on our processor, And each version of every register is going to be assigned a new real register. So the registers you use in assembly are going to be mapped each time you change them to a different real register. And this remapping is going to be called register renaming. So we're not just like going to mark a version number on the value of R8, we're going to in fact sort of make a new register for each use of R8s. And to support this, out-of-order processors typically have a surprisingly large register file. So my laptop probably has something like, on its single core, 96 registers, even though we only have 16 in assembly. Or maybe more than 96. And commonly, over 100 is not uncommon, even though in assembly we have 16 registers. And that's so we can store different versions of each of those 16 registers. And the typical way we're going to implement this is that we're going to do a version of this step of rewriting the instructions with, you know, the version numbers, but rather than having version numbers, we'll have the names of the actual registers in our big register file. So we'll name what I'll call architectural registers. So the term architectural registers means registers in the instruction set architecture, which are the ones you can see in assembly. So we'll convert the architectural registers to what we'll call physical registers, which are ones in our actual implementation of the processor. And each version of an architectural register will have a new physical register. And this is going to be the basis of not just handling forwarding in our out-of-order processor, this is also going to be how we figure out what instructions can we run. But because now that we have sort of a different name for each version of a value, we can figure out, can I run this instruction by looking at, are all the registers at once ready? So we'll track for each of these physical registers, is that value ready? When we're really tracking, is the right version of this architectural register ready? And that will tell us what instructions we can run. If the instruction uses that register value, it's ready to run, otherwise we have to wait for it. Okay, so we're going to look at this, but now that we know that this is sort of the idea, I'm going to give you sort of the pipeline, sort of high-level diagram for a typical out-of-order processor. So it's going to be a pipeline processor, but our pipeline stages are going to be a bit different. And I'm going to start over here. So we have an instruction cache and a fetch stage, just like our processor. You know, also note I have this box down here labeled branch prediction. So since we start multiple instructions per cycle, branch prediction in this processor is actually going to happen, you know, at least try to happen, before we fetch instructions. And you might say, wait a moment, how can I have any idea where things will go, you know, before I fetch instructions? Typically there will be something, some cache-like data structure recording recent branch targets, so that's how we can do it. So we'll have like a little cache of, here are recent jumps, so I can predict them, even before I fetch some of them. And of course, we'll, you know, also do some prediction after we fetch the instructions. And in this example, our decode stage is actually what you'd think of as decode. We're actually just processing the instructions. We aren't actually reading registers. Our register file is going to be over here. So we, you know, actually figure out what the instruction is, and then we have this rename step. So this rename step is where we're going to do, you know, that mapping of architectural to physical register. So we're going to convert the instructions from the register indices they have in assembly to the ones we're actually going to use here. And we're also going to record some information into something called a reorder buffer that we're going to use later on to make sure that we can sort of recover that mapping back to architectural registers later. In particular, for example, like if you have a seg fault, we want to figure out exactly what the, you know, values of RAX and so on were. And this is going to help us do that. So we're going to do some bookkeeping to do that. But the most, as for our instructions, they're going to go into this thing labeled as an instruction queue. So we're going to have a list in our hardware of instructions that have been pre-processed, and we're going to combine this with information about what registers, what physical registers, have their values ready. And the idea is that we're going to look at our list of physical registers that are ready and our list of instructions and say, which ones can I take off this queue? We're going to just take them off, you know, based on what's actually ready. And once we decide to run an instruction, we're going to have something which looks kind of like our normal pipeline. We're going to do our register read, also handle forwarding, if we have to do something other than just read registers here. And we're going to have our big register file. As I mentioned, typically we're running actually a lot of instructions at a time. So we're not going to just take one instruction off this instruction queue. We're going to take several. And that means we're going to read several registers at a time, which means our register file is not only really big as far as having like 100 registers, it also lets us like read 6 things at a time or 8 things at a time. And once we get our register values, we're going to send them to a bunch of different execution units. So these are things that actually do our instructions work. So this includes ALUs and also includes our data cache. So this is a slightly different design than what we've seen with where we have ALU data cache. Here, they're kind of separate. And we'll kind of specialize these execution units for different types of instructions typically, where the idea is that I don't need to have like 4 different dividers, even if I run 4 instructions at a time, because typically I won't have programs that want to run 4 divides at a time. So I'll have 1 divider, maybe a bunch of adders, because programs do more of that. And when I'm taking instructions, I'll have to keep in mind, where can I actually run them? So once the instructions run on our execution units, we'll do the write-back operation. So I have a write-back stage here, which connects to that same register file. And then there's this final new stage called commit. Sometimes you might also hear it called retire, which finalizes instructions. And this handles not only, I mentioned, the bookkeeping to like figure out like what the architectural registers are, like if we have a seg fault or something like that. This is also where we handle freeing up physical registers, because I mentioned each new version of a register gets a new physical register, we'd run out. So we have to avoid running out. So this is where we figure out, oh, I'm done using that version of the register. I don't need it anymore. I can reuse that one for something else later. So questions about this sort of overall out-of-order processor design? Okay, so let's look at our renaming stage. Also mentioned, the reorder buffer is also where we're going to track information to do branch prediction stuff. So if we need to squash instructions, that's a lot more complicated in this design. The reorder buffer is going to do the bookkeeping where we can go back to the correct versions of registers to squash instructions. That's going to be our strategy for doing squashing. Or the reorder structure is going to be one place where we could do that. There's other places we might also do that. Okay, let's talk about this renaming step. As I mentioned, we're going to take our architectural registers, turn them into physical registers. So let's think about what this step might be tracking. So here I have a bunch of instructions I want to do renaming on. And our renaming stage, well, we're going to have some sort of data structures that we keep in our hardware. One of them is going to be some mapping from the architectural registers to our physical registers. And on these slides, I've decided to name our physical registers, you know, X and a number. In the hardware, these probably just would be, you know, a number, right, that we pass into on wires. But just for clarity, I've named them X and a number to help us easily distinguish them from the physical registers that we see in assembly, which are the inputs to the stage. So we're going to have this mapping, which is this sort of current, you know, latest version of each register. And we're also going to have a list of physical registers that aren't used yet. And this is going to be filled in by our commit finalizing stage, where it figures out, oh, we aren't using this anymore, so it's going to add this back to the list. And we're just going to go through each of these instructions in order, and well, our first step is going to be that, okay, I need to look at this first instruction, uses R10. R10 is X19. I look at this R8. R8 is X13. So my first thing is that, okay, this is X18 and X13, X19 and X13, but also I need to have a new name for its output. So when we do this renaming step, even if we start with assembly, which has two operands, we're always going to give a new name for new values, because the new version needs a different name. So we're going to end up turning it into this kind of three operand type form, because we need a different name for the output than the inputs. So this is my post-process instruction. I looked up X19 and X13 in the table, and I said, oh, I need a new name for R8, because I have a new version of R8. So I popped the last top of the free list and assigned that name, and I updated my mapping of registers for the next instruction. So questions about my first renaming step here? Yes? Question, if the free register list is empty, do I have to stall? Yes. So if the free register list is empty, yeah, we're just gonna not make progress. Stall until it gets freed up, which should happen because eventually there will be instructions going into that commit stage to free up registers. Other questions? So then I do the next instruction, and I'm going to say, okay, I need R11, which is X07, I need R8, which is now X18, and I need to write that destination into a new location. So I'm going to name the new version of R8, well, I'm just going to take the next thing off my free list, X20. So I end up with this rewritten add instruction. And then I repeat that process, so now I need X12, X05, X20, and I'm going to name the next version of R8 X21. So questions about the renaming sort of process for this example? Okay, so if you look at another renaming example, which is a little more complicated. So here, my first instruction, well, we saw how that works. Just look up the two values. That's what we saw before. Now for the second one, I'm writing into memory and say, how does that work with this renaming? Well, if we think about this instruction, this rmoveq, we read from R8 and we read from REX. And we don't actually write to a register. So R8 is going to be X18. And REX is going to be X04. But we don't write to a register, so we don't actually need a new version of any register. So I'm going to write this like so. And you might say, wait a moment, how do we handle things that write to memory with out of order? And this is something we're not going to go into too much detail about, but I want you to know it is a problem. Because if we have two instructions that write to memory and we run them in a different order, well, we might get different values in memory if one is supposed to overwrite the other. And also, we might have problems if we have instructions that read from memory. So for example, we have this instruction here, and we need to know, you know, if it reads from the place we just wrote to memory, which might happen, because it might be the case that REX and 8 plus R11 are the same value, then we'd have to worry about that. And this is something that out-of-order processors need to handle, and there are basically two different strategies for doing this. So the simplest strategy is we can say, we're going to run arithmetic instructions out of order, but we're not going to run loads and stores out of order. We're going to keep run them in the order they appeared in the original code somehow. We're going to remember which is first. We're going to always run them in order. So that's one strategy. It turns out that strategy is pretty slow. So processors often implement a different strategy, which is that they will compare load and store addresses to see if there are conflicts, and if so, they will fix those conflicts by enforcing the ordering only when the comparison says you have a problem. And that is the most common strategy, even though, yes, that's very complicated to implement. But that's not going to be handled with registry naming. We're going to need something more complicated for that. That we're not going to go into the details of how you would compare the addresses and all that. Okay, so then we have a subtract instruction. This one at least is straightforward again. So we read from R8, which is X18, and we write to R11, which is X07, and we need a new version of R11. So I'm going to take X20, the next register, update my map. Then I have an MR move queue. So here, we read from R11, and we write a new version of R11. So the way I'll notate this is that this is, 8 plus X20 is the current version of R11, and we write a new version of R11, which is going to be X21, which I just chose off my list of free registers. Now I have a write IR move queue. So for an IR move queue, you might say, okay, we're going to look up R8. R8 is X18. We don't need to do that. Because, well, it doesn't. If we're implementing IR move queue, there's no reason to read the old value of R8. It doesn't matter. So I can just write it as, we're going to make a new version of R8, give a name for that new version. I'm not going to have to remember that what the old name was. That's going to be handled elsewhere. Yes? Question, why is R11 represented as memory? I wouldn't say, so this here is representing the 8 plus R11. I have memory here to remind me that when I'm figuring out when I can run this instruction, I need to take into account that issue of, is this a value which was just being written, and so on. Does that answer your question? So, yeah, so we haven't gone into the details, but there's some sort of mechanism we need to do for these memory instructions to remember that since this is reading from memory, it might depend on this instruction that writes to memory. That clarify? Okay. Other questions? Yes.
Since we're executing instructions out of order, does the register map also have to keep track of previous assignments for the architecture?
Question, since we're executing instructions out of order, does the register map also have to keep track of previous assignments? So that bookkeeping is going to happen elsewhere. It's true that we do need to know what those assignments are for cases of things like branch mispredictions and errors. So for example, let's say this RMoveQ seg faults, then we want to go back to the versions of the registers that existed here. And that sort of responsibility is mainly going to be handled by the reorder buffer, which I'm not showing you how that works. But there's some extra bookkeeping because, yes, we do need to sometimes go back to old versions. As far as writing new instructions, though, we don't actually care what the old version numbers are. The only reason we need to know is to make sure we can free up registers and to handle things like seg faults where we need to go back to higher versions of registers. Yeah. Would there ever be a situation where you execute the IR move queue before the subtraction? Absolutely. And if we looked at our rename version, not a problem. because the arrow move key uses x23, the subtraction doesn't use x23. So they're just completely independent instructions. There's no conflict. And that's sort of the elegance of this renaming solution, is that instructions that are independent just kind of look obviously independent after we do this renaming. Okay, so then we have our final add here. So we add from R11, which is x21, into R8, which is the old version's x23, the one we just made with this I remove Q. And then we produce a new version, which we'll call x24. Questions? Okay, so if we're all comfortable with this process, let's do some of this. So let me start with the first line. It's the first one. Yes?
So 13 plus 17 in R11.
13 plus 17? So x13? X13,
yeah.
Okay. X13 and x17, okay.
Yeah,
goes to x18. Goes to x18, okay. And this is an ab because plus. Okay. Anything else we have to do? Any other any bookkeeping I should do to handle this? Yeah. Okay. So you use that. Okay. So you need to free. Mark x18 is no longer free and update the map of R9 to x18. So questions? That process? Okay, so let's do our next one. Anyone help me? Next line, which is just move. What should I do for that? No volunteers, sir. Yes. Okay, so you make R10 x20, okay? Okay, remove x20 for free, and what do I write for my move instruction? x19 goes to x20 is what you want to write? Okay. So this is like follows our pattern. We don't actually need the x19 because the move instruction doesn't need the value of x19. So we're going to not write that, because that would be adding an extra dependency we don't care about. But we do have x20, so there we go. So 100 into x20, we don't actually need the old value of r10, so we're going to, and the renaming step is where we're going to figure that out. So we can avoid worrying about that dependency, which isn't a real dependency. How about r subtract? Yeah. So x21 is off our free registers, okay. And what else? R to be x21, and I see I probably need to update this slide for other reasons. Okay. And then I have my XOR here. So the process is I'm XORing. I want to go from R8, which is now x21, and R9, which is now x18, and that's going to go into x23, which is our new R9. And similarly, our AND is going to come from RAX and R9, which is currently x23, and go into a new register, which is going to be x24, which is a new version of R9. So that's our renaming process. Hopefully this seems pretty mechanical. So like it's not simple to implement, especially in hardware that actually does multiple instructions in a cycle, but it's straightforward process. So hopefully you understand how that works. Now there's some things where I didn't show you some like complicated instructions we've dealt with, and it seems like those might be problems. And there's two actually particular issues that are especially annoying. So one is that we have some instructions like say push or call, which have some additional hidden inputs and outputs, namely like the stack pointer. We have some instructions like conditional jumps, which have an additional input of condition codes. So how do we deal with those? And there's multiple solutions, but one solution is we can translate these instructions to make the additional inputs and outputs explicit. So for example, something we might do is we might say, rather than actually implementing pop in the later stages, in this renaming step, we'll convert pop to an add and an rmove key. That would be one possible implementation. And in the add and rmove queue, we have our actual stack pointer as an explicit parameter, and we're going to just do our registry naming on that, and we're going to have multiple physical registers that are used for different versions of the stack pointer. So that's one possible strategy. And we can also apply this for condition code. So rather than our compare instruction not writing to anywhere, we'll make up a register to hold the condition code information, and we'll have our jump read from that register, and we can do this in our renaming step. And this is why when I talked about RISC earlier in the semester, I said, you know, a lot of modern processors, kind of the instructions they're actually writing are more of the RISC-like ones. That's because this sort of translation happens. So commonly, you know, something like pop will actually be implemented as simpler instructions in after we have this renaming step. So questions about these sort of transformations to handle stack pointers, condition codes? Okay. So once we've done the renaming, we have this instruction queue and this list of ready registers. And they're going to use this to figure out what instructions to actually start running. So we'll call dispatching instructions. Let's think of how that works. So here I have an instruction queue, which is filled up with the results of our renaming. And you can see that I have instructions from actually multiple iterations of a loop. Because we're doing branch prediction, we're going to fetch ahead and keep going. So we have multiple iterations of a loop. We've done branch prediction, assuming the loop's going to keep going. And I have what I'll call a scoreboard, which is for each physical register, is it ready or is it or are you waiting for its value? And I want to figure out what instructions can I actually run. So how am I going to do that? Well, I'm going to look at each of these instructions and say, can I start this now? So for example, I look at instruction 1, and it needs X01 and X05. I look at my scoreboard, they're both ready, we can start this instruction. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, okay, let's put that instruction on an execution unit that can run it. In this case, I have two ALUs. It's an ALU instruction. We're going to use the first one, just arbitrary choice. Then I can look at my other instruction. So for example, here, I look at instruction 2. Say, can I run this down? And the answer is, well, no. It needs X02, that's fine. But it needs X06, which is not ready, I can't run it yet. I look at instruction 3. It needs X03, that's fine. It's X07, can't run that yet, not ready. And I do that for all the other instructions, and I find out that none of the other instructions I have in this instruction queue I can start yet. So even though I have the second ALU here, too bad, there's no instructions that can use it. And this is a surprisingly common thing that happens in out-of-order processors, is that even though they have the machinery, and even though they have this big list of instructions, none of them are ready. So I'm going to give up and just, you know, not actually put anything during cycle 1 in the second ALU. Too bad. Now, eventually, my first instruction will finish. And we're going to say that that's going to happen in one cycle. That's going to be our assumption here. Talk about what if it doesn't. So we're going to mark register 6 as ready because that's what it wrote to. So now that register is ready. And also, I can sort of say, cross this instruction off the queue, and I'm going to do the same process. I'm going to look at, I'm going to say this instruction here is done, but now I'm going to look at instruction 2, and now say, is X02 ready? Yes. Is X06 ready? Yes. I can start this instruction. So I'm going to start instruction 2 in the next cycle, in our current cycle now. I'm going to look at instruction 3. X03 is ready? Yep. X07 is still not ready. So I can't do that one, and I'm going to keep going and find out that the only instruction I can run now is instruction 2. So I'm going to run instruction 2, and only instruction 2, and then instruction 2 is going to finish, and I'm going to be on cycle 3. I'm going to do the same process for cycle 3. I'm going to find out that now that I've marked 7 as ready, I can run instruction 3, and none of the others actually work. Too bad. Okay, so there I'm done, and now I can, gonna do that. And now I get to something interesting here. So we finished instruction 3, and now we're thinking about cycle 4, what can I run? So let's look. We have this compare here. It needs X04, that is ready. So X4 is ready. It needs X8, that's also ready. So we can run this compare. This jump not equal, it needs X9, that's not ready. So can't run that yet. This add, it needs X1, that's fine. It also needs X8, that's also fine. We can run that add. So what we're going to end up doing is now, okay, I have two different instructions I can run. and I'm going to run them both at the same time. So I'm going to dispatch instruction 4 and 6. And in this case, instruction 6, is taking advantage, it's not only out of order, we're taking advantage of branch prediction. Like, we haven't actually checked whether the J and E condition is true or not yet. But we're still going to run it, assuming it is, because if it is, we're going to save some time. So questions about this state dispatching here? So I mark both of those as done, and now I get to my next stage, and I look at what instructions can I run now. And it turns out that X9, that's ready. X2 is ready. X9 is ready. X3 is ready. X10 is not ready. So it turns out that 5 and 7 are two instructions I can run. They both need the ALU in cycle 5. Now that we finished the instructions that write to X9 and X10. So I'm going to dispatch those two instructions, schedule them in cycle 5, and now I'm going to look at what instructions can I run. And X3 is ready, X10 is ready, I wrote code I shouldn't have written here. Okay. X10 is ready, so this is fine. And also, I should actually, based on the code I have written here, X4 and X11 are ready, so I should have two things I can dispatch now. Questions about, so we have during cycle 6, we'll get 8. Questions about what happened here? Yes? Question, what happens if the jump not equal isn't satisfied? So in that case, we're going to have to figure out how to squash the instructions after the jump not equal. And so there's logic, which is going to use that reorder buffer or possibly some other bookkeeping to figure out how to do that. The basic way we'll do that is we'll have to figure out what physical registers contain the values from before that jump, and we'll have to restore our mapping of the registers to that mapping. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah, so I was saying that if our in these out of order processors, when we have a branch misprediction, the squashing is a lot more expensive than it was on our pipeline processor. There's a lot more work. It's and our pipeline processor was kind of free. Here it's really not. So we have to do a lot of bookkeeping to update register mappings to do squashing. Okay. So let's look at a different example. So here I have two different execution units and different types of instructions. So what we're going to do here is I'm going to look for instructions to run. And so in this case, initially, I say, okay, I want X4, that's ready, so I can start this MRMove queue. So I'm going to put this MRMove queue. It needs the data cache, doesn't need the ALU, so it's going to use the data cache. I can also run instruction 2, but the problem is I don't have any place to put it. So I'm not going to run it right away. Can't run it during cycle 1 because presumably my data cache only takes one thing at a time. And then I'm going to but then I look at this add here, and oh, X1 and X2 are ready. I can start this add. So I'm going to end up starting instruction 3 and instruction 1 at the same time. And I have to pay attention to where I can put them, which execution units can actually use them. So then, after these run in cycle 1, now I will have this value ready, and X8 ready. And then there, I can look at cycle two. At cycle two, now I'll be able to start construction two. Great. And I can look at this instruction four here. It needs X1, which is ready, X6, which is ready. So that's going to be possible to do instruction four. And then finally in cycle, and so after that second cycle, our seven will be ready from instruction two, and nine will be ready from instruction four. And then in cycle three, I look and see, can I run instruction five? And the answer is going to be yes, one is ready, and seven is ready, so I'll run instruction five and presumably some other instructions. But notice that when I'm looking for instructions to run, I have to pay attention to where they can go, because we're going to have different types of execution units and not all going to be ALUs. And let's talk a little more about these execution units. Yes? What question? Why were we able to run the first instruction when 6 wasn't ready yet? Because 6 is the destination of the instruction. Sorry? Yes, and we didn't run the second instruction until cycle 2, first of all. We could have run it right away, though. We could have run the second instruction right away if we had another data cache slot, but we only had one. So if we had a data cache that let us submit 2 stores at a time, that would be fine. Here, it only let us submit 2 loads at a time, I should say. That would be fine, which some processors actually do, but our data cache only had 1 slot. So that's why we couldn't run instruction 2 during the first cycle. So if I had sort of data cache slot 1 and slot 2, that would have worked. So let's talk about execution units. So rather than, you know, this is where the actual work of the instruction is done. This is where our ALU, our data caches, and so on. And sometimes these are going to be pipelined. So typically not for things like adds, but for things like loading from the data cache, or like multiplies, or other more complicated arithmetic operations, or like floating point adds, these would be pipelined. So let's say we have a pipelined ALU, we'll input something, and it will take 3 cycles to give us an output. So exercise, how long does this take to compute A times B times C times D? If this is my ALU here, which we take, takes 1 thing every cycle and gives me the output 3 cycles later, it's pipelined. How long does this take? Any? Who would like some more time? No. Who has some idea of how would I figure out this answer? How long should this take to compute this calculation? Anyone? So what should the first thing we send to this ALU be to do this calculation? What's our first step? C times D. So based on how I've written this, C times D is the first step. So we're going to do C times D. And let's do our sort of timeline. So we're going to start C times D. And let's say we're starting it during cycle 1. And so this is going to do stage 1. Then during cycle 2, we're going to do stage 2 of C times D. And during cycle 3, we're going to do stage 3. So what else do we want to do for the, then what are we going to do next? We've done C times D, what's the next step? Yeah. Do you want to input A times B right away? So I like that idea. That's a great idea. It's something we're going to want to do later, but that's not the expression I wrote, unfortunately. So that would have been a better choice to write an expression that did A times B times C times D, but with the expression I wrote, the next step has to be multiplying by B. So it's B times the result we just got, and I can't do that until I have that result with the way I've written these parentheses. So I made some unfortunate choices here, which means that during cycle 4, I can do stage 1 of that multiply. Then 5, I can do stage 2. And 6, I can do stage 3. And then I'm going to need to do A times that result, and that's going to take me another 3 cycles. So it's end up going to be that this is, takes 9 cycles. And an observation that you might realize is that, oh, we probably could have done this faster if I had written my parentheses in a more intelligent way, but I insisted that I want to multiply B times C times D, not the other way around. So this is how our pipeline execution universe works. So if we had A times B times C times D, we'd be able to do A times B and C times D, kind of, we'd start A times B. So we do stage 1, stage 2, stage 3, for example, and we could do start stage 1 of C times D while we're doing stage 2 of A times B. That would have been a possibility with the other parentheses version, but not with this one. So another thing our execution units would have is that sometimes they're not going to be pipelined and they're going to take multiple cycles. So this is like our data cache. This is often how integer divide happens to be implemented. And in which case we'll have some sort of ready signal to tell us whether they can go or not. That's something we'll have to pay attention to. Okay, so let's look at how this affects instruction dispatch. So we're going to go through example here, and let's say in this example I have a one cycle ALU for additions, compares, conditional jump evaluations, but for multiplies I have this special ALU that's pipeline and takes 2 cycles. So how is our dispatch going to work for this? So what we're going to do is we're going to scan through these instructions for things we can run right away, and we're going to say, okay, when I look through this, I find out I can run the add and the first multiply. After that, either things aren't ready yet or I've run out of slots. And when I run this multiply, I have this sort of scheduling where I say, okay, I'm going to start it during cycle 1 and I know I'm going to finish it during cycle 2 because it takes 2 cycles and it's pipelined. So I'm going to finish these instructions. I'm going to mark X3, the thing that was produced by our add is ready. I'm not going to mark X6 as ready because, well, this multiply is not done yet. And then I'm going to look at what I can dispatch now and I can say, okay, 3 and 7, they are ready, so I can start that multiply. I can't start this compare because 8 isn't ready. I can't start this JLE because 9 isn't ready, but I can also start this add in their next iteration of what looks like a loop. And so I can start instruction 6. So questions on sort of what I was looking for there. So then I'm going to finish these, and now I'm going to move on to the next cycle. And now, finally, instruction 2 finished, so I can mark 6 as ready. And also, but instruction 3 hasn't finished, so like 8 is not ready, it's still pending, because we're still waiting for that to finish. And I look for instructions I can run, and I find that I have 4 is not ready, because I still need 8, but 7 is. So I can only run instruction 7, start instruction 7. Kind of annoying. So then Then during the next cycle, I can dispatch and finally run instruction 4 because its input 8 was ready. And I can also run instruction, start instruction 8. So that's sort of the process I'm going. So note that I'm sort of looking, need to look systematically, and I need to sort of take into account when I start instructions, that doesn't mean I can mark the register as ready right away if it takes several cycles to actually compute the results. So that's something we're going to need to take into account. Questions on sort of this instruction dispatch logic? Okay, so something you'll notice from the examples I've seen is that we can't always actually find things to run in an out-of-order processor. We have this logic which is tries very hard to look for instructions we can start. But often, we have all these instructions ready, and all the instructions we have depend on things that aren't ready yet. And this is very common. There's some other limitations. So another thing is that we have to also track all the instructions that haven't finished. And if we want to wait a while for like a slow load, this actually is a pretty big cost. And there's a lot of resources devoted to that. So to give some concrete sizes, the data structure that tracks the instructions that haven't finished is called the reorder buffer on Intel Skylake, which is my desktop processors from a few years ago. It has a 224 entry reorder buffer for each core. So it tracks 224 instructions that haven't finished yet. And it has 168 physical registers to track the different versions of values. That's pretty common. And another issue is that when we have branch misprediction, that fix-up is really expensive. So, for example, that we mentioned sort of the branch delay in our homework assignment. For an out-of-order processor like Intel Skylake, the branch delay cost is like 16 cycles. Like, it's sort of the bad case for a branch misprediction squashing. Okay. But we're going to look at this problem of how can we help these out-of-order processors find the correct instructions to run, right? We saw that in many cases I came up with, we have these sort of examples where you have tons of instructions, but there's no actual work to do. That can be done now. We have to wait for something. We're just waiting. And a way we can analyze this is something we'll call the data flow model. So rather than sort of looking at list of instructions, I'm going to just look at sort of operations and their dependencies. Now we think of our instruction queue, sort of each of these ovals here represents an instruction, and the arrows represent their operands, their inputs, which come from either initial values or other instructions. And we can use this to visualize when can we actually start instructions, and when can we run instructions together. And one thing we can kind of observe is that we don't see dependencies between instructions that we can do, you know, these all at the same time. So here, the things I've highlighted, they're kind of independent of each other. So looking at this diagram, I can guess that, oh, we can do these three things at a time, and this design here will let us, you know, do three operations per cycle, assuming our processor has the capacity, you know, the execution units to do that. And another thing we can observe is that I have this sort of chain here, and because these each depend on each other, they have to happen one at a time. So the amount of time I need to run this on an out-of-order processor is going to have to be the sum of all these operations at least. And that's because we think of that instruction queue, I'm going to have to run the first add and wait for it to finish, then I can do the second add. I can't dispatch the second add until the first one's done. And so on. And our book calls this phenomenon the critical path of our data flow here. And this tells us sort of a limitation on how fast our out-of-order processor, no matter how efficient that instruction queue is, and how much work it's doing on branch prediction, it's a limitation of how fast it can run our program. Because ultimately, it has to do each of these adds, one after the other. It's what we told it to do, it has to do that. And so our minimum time is the sum of these latencies. This also tells us, if we remember when I talked about loop unrolling, why adding more and more loop unrolling stopped helping. Because our loop unrolling operation was basically sort of doing this comparison every once in a while, and in our out of order processor, that didn't add to this critical path. Like, that could just be done in parallel, right? That's an independent operation in this data flow diagram. So it was kind of free, but the limitation was we had to run an add, then run the next add, and what was happening is our processor was just running out of things to run in that instruction queue. And that's why we ended up sort of plateauing in performance for loop unrolling. Questions? Okay, so let's talk about, so this should be familiar for other cases. So here I have my two different orders, and we learned from looking at, when I talked about pipelining in that for our ALU, that this one should be better. So let's say instead of having 3 cycles, we have 5 cycles. How long does each of these take? And my hint is that we should think about the data flow graph. That's going to help us sort of make a quick idea of what sort of the plan is going to be. So here are 2 data flow graphs. Questions, or rather, anyone who needs more time, or would like more time? Okay. So let's start with the left case. So remember, we're looking for a 5-cycle multiplier. So who thinks that this case will take? Let's start with 10 cycles for the left side. 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, more than 15, less than 10, no clue. Okay, so we all have pretty good consensus that this is 15 because we have to do this. Then that multiply, then the other multiply, and they each take 5 cycles, and we have to wait for them to finish entirely. Okay, how about our case on the other side? So let's say, who thinks it's going to take 10 or fewer cycles? 11 cycles? 12 or more cycles? No clue? Okay, so we have a split between 10 or fewer and 11. So I think people who said 10 said, oh, well, if we look at our longest path here, this says 5, and this is 5, so that's 10. Now, the problem is that we have just a single multiplier. So we actually run into a problem with the single multiplier. So what we end up having to do is that we do A times B. We do its 5 stages. And we want to do C times D, but we want to start it at the same time. And unfortunately, we don't have enough multipliers to do that, so we have to start it right afterwards. And then we can do the final multiplication after that. And this ends up being, overall, this ends up being 11 cycles. So it would be fine if we had more multipliers, but it would be 10 if we had more multipliers, but we only have one. So it ends up being 10. But you can see that the data flow diagram is a very quick way of coming up with something which is pretty close, but it's not exact. So questions on how I got that answer of here for 11 and not 10? Okay, so we're gonna look at using the data flow diagram as a quick way of estimating sort of how will things perform in an out of order processor. We know it's not gonna handle all the details. And one thing I'm going to say is we're going to go back to our example of doing our sum, and here's a better way of doing the sum from a data flow point of view. So instead of summing up one sum, I'm going to produce two sums, two partial sums, and add them together at the end. And if we look at our data flow, now we have sort of, kind of looks like we have six independent things we can do at once. So we have more work for our processor with lots of ALUs. So maybe you can fill all those ALUs. And also our longest path for doing seven ads only has four of them in it, because we can do two ads at once that are useful, whereas before we had to do one ad at a time. So this is kind of applying this idea of just changing the order of operations to our loop. So this idea is called multiple accumulators, because the sum is an accumulator, and code for it might look like this. So this is something we do after loop unrolling, when we have some sort of accumulating value, like a place where we're getting a sum or a product. And this is going to dramatically help us because our performance on an out-of-order processor, because now when we're doing that instruction dispatch, we look for things that are ready to do. Now we have two different ads we can do at a time every time. Whereas before, well, often we just had one. So questions on this transformation and why it helps our out-of-order processor. Okay, so this idea of multiple accumulators, so I can run it. So I tried this with this example, and we can do this not just with two sums, but we can do more than two. We can do four, something like that. So I did that. So I started with a 16 times unrolled loop, so loop with 16 copies of the loop body. So I started with the unrolled version, and I used one accumulator, so one sum variable, 2, 4, 8, and 16. And I measured the performance I got, and the number of instructions was 3. So you can see that this is an optimization which often increases the number of instructions we run, and well, that's because the more accumulators I have, the more stuff I have down here to add them together at the end. But it still has a huge performance impact, you know, because I'm giving the processor more things it can do at the same time. And you can see I got my performance way down, almost twice as fast. You might say, why wasn't it twice as fast? We'll talk about that later. Another question we might have is, what's happening here? Why does it plateau, and why does it get worse? So let's start with why it plateaus. So it plateaus because at some point I run into a case where, you know, the processor can only do so many ads at once, and I've probably exhausted that capacity. You might say, why doesn't it plateau at half? We'll get to that probably next time. You might say, why does it get worse? Anyone have ideas for that? Why at 16 did it get way worse? My hint is, how many registers, my laptop runs x86-64, how many registers do I have in assembly? Someone's saying 16. So why is this a problem? Yeah. So we run out of registers, so we're gonna put stuff on the stack or something like that. Yeah, that's what my compiler did. So the assembly code for this, the 8 accumulator version looks, uses lots of registers. Great. For the 16 accumulator version, my compiler is copying to the stack. That's extra work. That's why things got slower. So questions on that? So that's why we have it getting slower at the end. We're giving, yes, there's more ads you could run at the same time, but the processor doesn't have more adders. And also, we're doing extra work to store and load the values we're adding, so that stock hurts. Let's say, what about this 0.57? Why is this 0.57 instead of 0.5? We're doing two ads at a time. That seems to be our limit. Why is it 0.57 and not 0.5? Where is that 0.07 coming from? And you can kind of measure what's going on here by counting the instructions. So I have two additions per element, plus I have 3/16 of an add, subtract and compare, and 1/16 of a branch per element. If I'm just counting how many instructions are in the loop, divided by the number of elements the loop handles, and so I end up with 2.25 instructions per element. And that quarter of instruction, so that's how many instructions I have per element, and it turns out that my processor can run about 4 instructions at a time. That's how many ALUs I have, that's how many register renamings it can do, and that gives me 0.57 cycles per section. So that's where that came from. So I could have improved this by reducing this quarter here, which came from our loop overhead, by doing more loop unrun. So now that I made more stuff for the processor to do, the loop overhead started mattering again. So that's where I'll finish up this time, since I'm out of time, more than out of time. So next week, we don't have class on Tuesday. We have a lab on Wednesday, which is going to cover multiple accumulators and loop unrolling.